This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Today, an interview with author, actor, and Marine veteran Benjamin Bush. He has led a series of workshops at Western Michigan University this fall called Talking Service. They allow veterans and their families to discuss and perhaps write about their experiences on the battlefield and at home. The final workshop for this fall is scheduled for Wednesday at Schneider Hall. I spoke with Benjamin Bush in September. You are the son of a novelist, Frederick Bush, who people may have read his stuff or at least have heard of him. But I've heard you say that you did not grow up thinking about being a writer. How did you get there?
I always thought that my strongest, skill set was always in the visual arts. I thought that I could express myself through imagery. And my father, of course, had always been obsessed with language instead. And, you know, the old maxim that one is not the other is not true. I came to writing very late. Actually, in my first tour in Iraq, you were allowed to send home letters for free, written on anything, a piece of cardboard box, whatever was lying around. There wasn't much paper. And so every once in a while, I would write home. And it was really the first time that I'd, by circumstance, been given only language to describe my situation. And we didn't have any reporters. There was nobody particularly interested in the Iranian border in 2003 as everyone rushed to Baghdad and left us there. So there was no sense at home of what any of us were really doing, and it required sentences. And I had to begin in my own, my own mind to take these mostly images I was seeing and apply language to them in a way that someone could recreate far away. And so letters home were really my first serious language upon which I was dependent to really speak and see. And that's where I realized that transference was possible with words. I kind of didn't believe it the same way my father had, because I thought I could, well, if I show you, then we both have a common frame of reference. It looks like this. But I couldn't show you even in an image what it felt like, what it sounded like, what it smelled like. An image couldn't do that. And so I really gained my appreciation of what my father had done his whole life, not until I was 35, which sounds stunning that I could be so set against its possibilities. That's where I first realized it. In my second tour in Ramadi, which was just a vicious tour, once a month I wrote a letter home to friends and family. And that's where that was serious prose. That's where I brought the full weight of language to bear many times, because I thought it would probably be the last they'd ever hear from me with those letters. I never knew if I'd make it to the next month. And I look at those letters now and I think, I think I got a lot of things right.
So going back before that, how does someone who, is the son of a novelist who goes to Vassar, studies the visual arts, decide at some point that he's going to be a Marine?
Well, a lot of people think that the two can't live together, that they're entirely different disciplines. And for me, the Marines and the artist were braided, just kind of interconnected, and at a certain point, almost interdependent. I wanted to be a knight when I was a kid. It sounds romantic and silly, and to a certain extent, that's exactly what it is, because there's no consequence in those childhood perceptions of what war is, what honor is, what duty is. But I had it in me, always. And even though my parents were Vietnam War protesters, there's no way they wanted me to head in that direction, and they certainly never encouraged it. But they also, they saw in me who I was, and they didn't stop me, which I think is the greatest gift a parent can give a child, is to let them be who they are. And so after 3 years at Vassar, in between my junior and senior year, I went to Officer Candidate School, which is where they evaluate you for the Marine Corps if you're going to be an officer after graduation. And it was absolutely miserable, and I loved it. There was something about its impossibility, the fact that they didn't want me to make it, that that pulled exactly the right strings with me. I was always kind of a stoic and drawn to a certain type of physical suffering to prove that I couldn't be destroyed. And the Marines seemed like exactly the right place to test that over and over again. And so after graduation, I I went in as a young second lieutenant to be an infantry officer.
If you had never joined the Marines, had never served, had never seen combat, do you think you would have found that path ultimately to writing? Or did you have to go through that to really discover that within yourself?
I may have. I may have required extremity. I've always kind of worked from a particular kind of chaos. Even my visual work is just strewn about me. I pull reference and influences from my surroundings all the time, like everybody does, like writers do, like artists have always done. Everyone's kind of a collage artist, whether they're using language or images, just because no one grows up in a black box. But whether I would ever come to language, I'm not sure. I became a filmmaker, and those need a script. So on some level, I had to deal with conversational language. I had to deal with dialogue. And I don't know if that would have been my way into prose writing or not.
So when you're leading a workshop like those at Western Michigan University for veterans, do you have to draw out certain people sometimes to get them to try and express themselves? Are they, you know, perhaps they've had a bad experience overseas. Maybe they are still kind of getting used to being a civilian again. And do you have to work with them, I guess, gently, at least for some of them?
I work with all that gently. I work with my own work with absolute cruelty. I'm brutal to myself, but in workshop, that's not my position. What's true for every artist is it has to come out of the artist. I don't know that I can draw anything out of anyone. But if I can show them a pathway, even by example, you know, the hope is in these little gatherings that something that someone wrote echoes in their own experience. And even though it's not going to be the same, it never exactly is, it can show them that, first of all, that their experience is important. I can't even tell you how many veterans I've spoken to who don't think that anything they did was ever important, that they just did a small job somewhere, you know, whether it was in Germany or whether it was in Oklahoma, and they did it for 3 or 4 years and they were good at it, and then they went home again and they think that that wasn't significant. And I can't, it's so wrong. When they begin to talk in these workshops or other people talk around them about things which were hilarious, just the funniest stories come out of military service, just a bunch of people sitting around, usually bored, when we see how bizarre we are as creatures. And then suddenly they remember, oh yeah, for 3 years, I was in that funny group, or I was in that misery, or I was in something which was, you know, beyond my early dreams of what I'd ever do. I never thought I would be on Okinawa. I never thought I would be in the Horn of Africa. And no matter how isolated their job is, they were exposed to an entire new world. They traveled, they left home. They've done something extraordinary, even if in their own mind they're looking around thinking that it wasn't. And I think that's where storytelling begins, because they've all told stories. Even the most reticent and quiet of them, I think it's usually just they see it in someone else and realize that they carry it too, and it's worth exploring.
Do you find that veterans have to be drawn out a little bit in terms of maybe their most horrific experiences, that those can still be tough to talk about even when you're meeting with them years or decades later?
Absolutely. I mean, we have World War II veterans, Korean and Vietnam veterans, and These are people who have had decades and decades to either try to cover this all up in their heads or to try to find a way to express it. And many of them are haunted to their deaths by the things that they can't say, the things that they couldn't find someone else saying for them. It's not my intention to make anyone write their histories, write their biographies, to be therapeutic, although all these things tend to happen. And whether it's for their own families or the archive that we keep of American experience in the Library of Congress, et cetera, I think the hardest part for a lot of veterans is their isolation from people who have a shared experience. And they just simply believe that no one could understand. And when they're in another group of people, even if they haven't had a shared experience of being in a particular war or fighting or anything, they all went to boot camp. They all began with a singular mission, you know, which was to serve the nation and be part of an incredible machine. Whether you like that or not, that's what they did. And I think sometimes hearing other people just begin that discussion where they all realize they're part of a tribe, and it's an immense tribe, millions of people in it, men and women, but they're in the tribe. And that's when I think you begin to hear people speak to things which they've kept from everybody else. And it's not because they were a secret. It's just they just didn't think anyone would understand, would get it. And it's the old joke, you know, about the veteran. How many veterans does it take to change a light bulb? You know, you wouldn't understand. You know, that's the answer. Right. There's no answer for that. And some people really feel that. They really feel that that there isn't language for what they've seen and done, that there isn't an audience to hear the story they really want to tell. I'm that audience. This group is that audience. And everyone gets something from it. Sometimes it's those stories that bring out the story of another who needed someone to start speaking.
How were you wounded in Iraq?
We were on our way to a headquarters on what was considered a permissive route. There's a lot of interesting military words you begin to learn, which is great for a writer. We call things, you know, just the strangest stuff. Like your pen is not a pen, it's an ink stick. You know, I'm not wearing sneakers, I'm wearing GoFasters because they're faster than boots. I don't name these things, but I know the names of them.
As a writer, it's good to incorporate.
It's great stuff because sometimes, you know, people almost talk in a code and military talk. Only some of it really gets its way into the American dialogue. The vernacular, like good to go is a military term. Mm. You know, you're good to go to the war. But we all say that now for everything. And so we were going past a corner, and it had been mined with a 155-millimeter artillery round, which had a small receiver, transmitter, attached to the blasting cap in the front, you know, the igniter. And all they had to do was make a phone call. It's basically the small bit of electricity that a cell phone emits when receiving a call is all the electrical current it needs to set off an artillery round if you wire it in. And it went off and just cut shreds through the side of our vehicle. And everyone in the vehicle was wounded. I was the first one out of the vehicle trying to find a way to secure our situation. I also wanted to find out who did it, which I could not. We were surrounded by Iraq and surrounded by traffic. And I was lucky. I had my back to the blast because I didn't trust the bridge we were passing near. So I was looking at that. And the blast came from behind me, and, you know, pieces of hot metal just went into my arm. The rest of it stopped in my flak. So looking around the vehicle, which I had to do very briefly, trying to assess the situation, I was a senior man on the truck. We were just, this was a very administrative move. We were not prepared for what became of us that day. You know, there were people missing parts of them. And someone who was sitting right next to me had a small sliver of metal that went underneath his neck guard. And we didn't know what was wrong with him. He had just frozen. And I thought it was shock. So I was kind of getting us to treat him for that. But in fact, his body had involuntarily locked in the sitting position. And we took him out of the truck as if he was sitting in a chair because his body would not move. So he was still in a seated position as we carried him around. It was like magic, you know, like possession. And the body is an incredible organism. It doesn't want to die. And it knew that if it moved, that one tiny piece of metal in his neck could sever the artery and he would have bled out in moments. We wouldn't be able to save him. And he survived. But that was... my wounding was kind of the least interesting part of it for me. I didn't even take stock of it until we got to the casualty center. And then I kind of realized that my arm wasn't just hurting. It was, you know, it was damaged.
And I bring it up because you have talked before about the idea that you at once feel invincible and yet there's a sense of doom that surrounds you when you go off into combat. And I wonder if that becomes a little more real at that point. Does maybe the realization that your mortality is at stake become that much more obvious to you in that moment?
Absolutely. And I talk about that a little bit in my book, Dust to Dust. But my first tour, I kind of had to wear invulnerability as if it was truth. You know, it's fantasy. But I carried it that way to the point where I even believed my own myth. And I did it for my Marines. I was, you know, a company commander at the time. And they looked to me for a certain stability, whether they liked me or not. That was my position, was to be invulnerable. And although I didn't run around like I couldn't be shot, I also began to not believe it at all. Like, really, not like a crazy person, but I just didn't believe myself to be in threat. And in my second tour, I was wounded that first 2 weeks. We were just doing a change of units. And that's why I was on my way over to the headquarters from Hurricane Point. That's what it was called, a Marine position in Ramadi, the city of Ramadi, up the road from Fallujah. And when that happened, I thought, okay, well, I'm definitely going to be killed this time. The city was just a disaster, and I was going to be very obvious in it because of my position. I would be someone they'd be looking for if anyone cared to check on who was in charge of things. And so they became the same kind of feeling. I can't remember what I wrote, but it's being immortal and being doomed created the same lack of anxiety in me. Because if you're immortal, you're not worried. And if you're dead already, you're not worried. And I felt that to the point where when I left Iraq, I didn't care. Like so many people you hear about pining for home. I didn't pine for home because I was dead. And when I got home, that was the hardest adjustment, was this strange gift of not being dead. And it took me a while to find any comfort in that.
And this is with a family at home.
A family at home. I had a little baby that I came home to on her very first birthday. I was suddenly presented with being a husband and a father again after having been in that environment where there was only really a couple of things at work, and the biggest one was death.
So since you were over there for two tours and saw it firsthand, and I realized that you're stationed at different places and you don't see everything, but what would you say is the greatest misperception you hear from people when they talk about Iraq who never went over there, civilians?
Well, that's very complicated. You know, Iraq is three countries, first of all. You know, if we'd listened to Lawrence, it might have been three countries, a Shia, a Sunni, and a Kurdish state. I thought we were going to turn them into those three countries when we had all the power there was, but we did not. We restored it to, you know, its centralized government for the sake of convenience, really. And when you apply democracy to a place that suddenly realizes it has minorities, suddenly everyone who is a minority is not happy. And the Sunnis realized they had 20% forever. And I remember one guy, you know, really a wizened Iraqi in Ramadi, who was a judge. And I was trying to explain, you know, the benefits of democracy, you know, because that's what we were selling, you know, the freedom of choice. And he said, I see the news, and in America, when the Democrat Party and the Republican Party only have 49%, they say they can't get anything done until there's another election. And I said, well, I have to admit, because of partisan politics, you're correct. And that's something we need to overcome in my country. And he said, well, imagine if either party had 20% on their best day. Would you ever get anything, or would you have to fight? So I couldn't argue with his logic. And that's when the civil war really began in earnest between the Shia and the Sunni. The Kurds didn't care either way. They kind of had free range to the north. You just never knew exactly what Iraq was going to do, because I think its biggest problem was Iraq had no sense of itself. And in order to be a nation, that's the first thing you need to have. That's the only thing you can fight for, is if you have a clear sense of definition. The Kurds had that. And then the Islamic State came in. And they were invited in by the Sunnis, who realized that they couldn't win with a vote. And Maliki was cutting them off. This is a whole different period of what Iraq was. And they're still dealing with that now.
So let me segue into a somewhat lighter topic. somewhat, because while you were still on duty in Iraq, in between actually tours, as I understand it, was part of the time that you were acting on the wire.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering, I mean, how do you know that you could make time to actually be on a critically acclaimed television show and know that, you know, when you're done with that, you're going to have to go back and continue your duty as a Marine?
I didn't know. I got out of the Marines after my first tour. I got out of the Marines three or four times before that. It's kind of like that The Godfather. It's when I'm out, they pull me back in. And I did get continually pulled back in. My sense of responsibility.
So by your own choice?
My own choice, yeah. I was given involuntary orders. But I thought I could fix Ramadi. I thought I could save it from becoming Fallujah. That was our job. Because I learned so much on my first tour, I was the one. I just saw so many mistakes happening, which I thought were obviously mistakes, that maybe I could, you know, change that. Maybe I figured something out in my first tour. Between that and reading Seven Pillars of Wisdom by Lawrence of Arabia, I was somehow going to cure Iraq in one spot. You know, the biggest danger you have is feeling that you have something of value, becoming good at something to the point where you believe you're necessary. The military will move on without you always. It's a very large organism, but your blood vessel in it, somehow you feel it's a piece of brain tissue instead. And I thought that I could change the course of history in a small place and keep a few Marines alive in that city. So I went to that city specifically, which was the worst place there was, and found myself to be incapable, you know, of stopping that. So in between there, I went back to doing what I do. I was a filmmaker, and I auditioned for a show that was on HBO that I hadn't seen because I'd been in Iraq, that everyone said was great if they were smart, and everyone else hadn't watched at all. And I was cast for one line in one episode as just a police officer in the background. And it was interesting because I'd finally tried to grow my screaming monkey Marine cut out, let the hair come out on the sides. I'd grown some scruff in my face, all of which felt like a violation of some kind. And I auditioned with that, and I guess I looked bitter enough after that tour to have some certain energy that I was projecting for this cop. And I got to set, and the director said, you know, I think we want to make you look a little more edgy. I'm like, more edgy than this? And they shaved the sides back on the, you know, like the one cut. I couldn't get a job as an actor for all the years I'd been in the Marines, in the reserves or otherwise. And they restored the sides but left the top longer and left the kind of a foo on the front. And I probably had the harshest haircut in television for a while. But yeah, the entire season shot out. And then I went back to Iraq for 2005, came back just in time for the next season of The Wire to begin.
And you were on it through the end of the series almost.
Yeah, I was a minor supporting character as Cleecho, who kind of came in late. It wasn't time to develop yet another storyline, which they had so many already running for. But for someone who was supposed to have one line in one episode, you know, I ended up being an 18 because they kind of liked, I think they liked the fact that they didn't have that uncompromising cop, the one who sees everything in black and white while the rest of the show is obviously watching it in gray. And so I'm constantly furious with everybody. And it was kind of the perfect role to have after Iraq, because what could be more disappointing than that?
Was it also, in a way, I don't know, therapeutic to play someone who I just gather is quite different from who you are? I mean, you're sitting here talking to you. You do see the world in shades of gray. You see nuance. So to throw yourself into this role where you get to play this guy who says, hey, the law's the law. Okay, we got to follow orders, but man, we should be locking people up. I mean, was there something that was, you know, I don't know, almost visceral in being able to play that role?
Well, yeah, certainly. Also, because, you know, I had to disguise my frustration in Iraq. as the officer meeting with all these villagers, the worst thing you can possibly do, and we did it everywhere in Iraq, was insult anyone by being upset with them, disregarding their cultural predispositions. I mean, in Iraq, a lot of what you hear is a lie, and you have to ask questions around it to find the pieces of truth in it, because it's a cultural thing. For many years, especially under the Ba'ath Party, why would you tell the truth? And why would they trust us? So I was always frustrated in meetings because I would only get a piece of what I needed to know to be able to help them. And of course, the way the war was being administered, when they disbanded the entire military in Iraq and just turned the entire country into a bunch of unemployed military-trained 18-year-olds with AKs, I'm thinking, okay, this is bad policy, and we're going to have to deal with this on a blood level at some point. So a lot of things were happening that I was looking at as being, you know, disastrous, but I couldn't express it that way. I couldn't play the angry officer all the time because, of course, your unit's going to become sour. And so I came back from hiding all that to be a total bastard on the streets of Baltimore, where that guy exists in our culture.
Hey, shut it down. It's a police operation here.
Let's get back to your post. Let's back these vehicles up.
Excuse me, officer.
I'm not telling you again.
Tony, calm down.
The absolutist was allowed to run free and undisguised and unfiltered. And that was Colicchio. And my favorite roles are where I get to be anyone but me, where I get to truly hide in someone other than myself with a different background, something I really have to think my way into and act. I think the hardest role I ever had was in Generation Kill, which after I'd left my second tour, we went to shoot Generation Kill for HBO. It's a 7-part miniseries about the invasion of Iraq by 1st Marine Recon. We shot it in Africa. The war was still going on, and I was dressed as a Marine again, playing a Marine officer.
So this should be the role that you're meant for,
it should
right?
have been the easiest thing in the world, but the entire time, it was hard to be natural because I felt it was acting. I felt being myself to be, you know, not genuine on a certain level, even though it's the most genuine thing I could do. So it was actually the thing I struggled the most with, was playing something that was just me.
One last question for you I have to ask. As someone who grew up in New York, obviously ended up in Hollywood for a while, served in Iraq, for The Wire, you're on the streets of Baltimore. How do you end up in Northern Michigan from all that?
Well, my wife is a Russian historian. She teaches at Ferris State. And if you're in the humanities, you know that you take the job that's available on the entire earth. But she took a job at Ferris State, where she's been for 10 years now. And after Iraq, I wanted a big piece of farmland, anything I could find. And this is just before the big crash. So there wasn't much available. And we got a place in a town called Reed City, a few miles out of it on 7 Mile Road, 80-acre farm, which was a complete disaster, just a wreck. And being who I am, I'm a builder, a stonemason too, when I was younger, I kind of looked at it and said, you know, I can fix that. It's still a complete mess if you come to visit, but I've done some things to it, and that's where we stay. That's why I've been planting apple trees, and in our back lot, in the back 40, I planted kind of on my own quietly 4,486 trees. And it's one for everyone we lost in Iraq. Now, it's obviously not including Iraqis. It's not including anybody else, but
U.S.
military.
Troops were killed.
Yeah, I looked at the list from the Department of Defense, and I planted a tree and say a name. I thought it was the best thing I could do is replace a life with something alive, something that would live beyond me. I'll never see it as a forest. I think that's what the country needs to be thinking. You know, we need to be thinking for a future that's beyond us, not our immediacy.
Benjamin Bush, thank you very much for your time.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me again.
Actor, writer, and Marine veteran Benjamin Bush will lead the final talking service workshop for this fall on Wednesday at Western Michigan University's Schneider Hall. A link with details about the program for veterans and their families can be found at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.